Hi, and welcome to episode 9 of the Unpacking Weight Science podcast called Morality versus Ethics: Why Fat is Fraught. I'm your host, Fiona Willer, weight neutral professional development dietitian, academic, and size acceptance advocate. Over the next 25 minutes or so, I'll be looking at fatness and fat medicine through the lens of the four key principles of medical ethics: autonomy, beneficence, non-maleficence, and justice, and compare and contrast them with the five foundations of morality: care, fairness, in-group loyalty, authority, and purity. In this podcast, I'm using the term fat medicine instead of obesity medicine for a specific reason. The term obesity is directly related to the arbitrary cutoff of a BMI of 30, which serves no health promotion purpose. Those who identify working in obesity medicine, obesity research, or obesity activism prescribe almost entirely to an anti-obesity perspective. They're actively working to try to make larger bodies smaller, prevent bodies from getting larger, and seeing larger bodies as inherently problematic. Fat medicine, on the other hand, refers to the provision of healthcare to people in larger bodies, which aims to enhance health outcomes and treat disease effectively in the bodies they have right now, without the pursuit of weight change. Medical ethics can be thought of as a form of morality. It sets out what the philosophical principles that providers of healthcare define as being right. I want to acknowledge that particularly the medical ethical principles that I'm discussing here are built upon the tradition of Western historical medical ideals and the Eastern, Middle Eastern, and other cultural traditions of providing good and just care to others differ from these. Particularly when we look at Arabic medical traditions, there's far less credence given to personal autonomy. Instead, the impact on the family, community, and opinion of elders takes precedence over the wants and needs of the individual. You'll see when I get to the foundations of morality, which have been found to be consistent across diverse cultures, how that could end up being the case. So let's take a look first at principles of medical ethics: autonomy, beneficence, non-maleficence, and justice. Autonomy means that people should be able to determine for themselves what course of action they will take. In reality, of course, this capacity to choose or have autonomy is controlled by medical gatekeepers, so the healthcare professionals who would have to support the person when following a course of action. In obesity medicine, people in larger bodies are often infantized, treated like they have the maturity level of children, which undermines their right to autonomy through both overt treatment withholding, like restricting certain surgeries to lower weight people only, and unconscious bias, such as when a healthcare professional presents fewer options to a patient because they assume the patient needs things either to be made easy or won't make a responsible decision if given the power, or doesn't have the capacity to understand complicated options. Healthcare providers who use the appearance of someone's body as evidence for particular things about their lifestyle or values immediately devalue that person's autonomy. Paternalism is woven into the fabric of medicine, and many health professionals do not realize that they're being condescending, serving their own ego with the false belief that their expertise in a particular body system makes them an expert in someone's life, let alone give up that power easily. For people in larger bodies, navigating the system that's stacked against them, if they're unaware of the inequities in healthcare, it's likely that they're conditioned to being treated this way. We have to help people fight for the right to informed consent by spreading the existence of another way of doing things that doesn't involve trying to become smaller. Secondly, we have beneficence. That is, that a practitioner should act in the best interest of the patient. This too is obviously impacted by paternalism and human nature. Healthcare professionals will unconsciously project their own personal values all over the patient unless they've interrogated their own baggage and can catch themselves. In the realm of body weight, if the practitioner believes that a smaller weight is better no matter what, they're going to prioritize that perspective, even if the process of losing weight would be psychologically or physically harmful for that person. This area is directly impacted by cultural fat phobia. The medical literature for a long time was clear that higher weight was a risk factor for chronic disease, which means it's just one in a long list of risk factors such as high blood pressure, waist circumference, age, genetics, fitness, etc. But when obesity was redefined as a disease in itself in the US, suddenly there was a shift to have to actively treat it, which was interpreted as needing to try to make it go away rather than ramping up screening programs for those conditions that high weight is associated with. For example, fair skin is a risk factor for a type of skin cancer called melanoma. But instead of trying to make people's skin darker if they're fair-skinned, the screening recommendations were changed to include more accurate and frequent skin checks in order to catch it and treat it earlier. For fat medicine, this would be the model to take. Increased alertness for conditions associated with larger body sizes in order to diagnose early and treat effectively. The problem with defining a whole disease based on one completely arbitrary metric that really is more of a risk factor than a disease is that it leaves you with only one way to escape the disease, and that is to decrease that metric at any cost. And this leads directly to ignoring the other factors which increase the risk of the actual conditions that you're trying to avoid by trying to avoid being a higher weight. The third medical ethical principle is non-malfeasance. This means, firstly, do no harm. And it posits that it's worse to harm someone than to not do them good. It's a key part of the Hippocratic Oath that doctors take, and many have argued that it's the most important of these ethical principles. It's certainly of primary concern in research ethics considerations, although sadly, the harms involved with intentional weight loss are rarely considered, even in groups that are officially considered vulnerable, like kids. It's a travesty that because those who research weight centrism-related harms try to avoid causing harm, yet others working with the same populations have no such concerns and carry on conducting research that they have no idea is harmful because they aren't monitoring or asking in any way to find out if it is harmful. Clearly, this principle is also dependent on the values of those in power, and clear harm or benefit tends to be the exception rather than a rule. So this concept of harm changes over time, depending on the norms of the society, medical practice, and particularly the balance between harm to an individual versus harm to a community. I'm going to talk about the rationalizations around weight loss trade-offs in the next section on justice. So with keeping the focus just on avoiding doing harm, the problem in the system is that we haven't actively sought investigation of harms related to weight centrism, that is harms related to pathologizing higher weights and harms resulting from recommending weight loss. Weight loss studies, if they study any psychological constructs at all, have tended to focus on depression and body image, both of which are improved when actively dieting, but come back the same or worse when the weight is inevitably regained. These effects should be explained by a boost in positive affect with the anticipation of weight stigma avoidance that dieting often brings. They're anticipating no longer being the target of weight stigma and achieving all of those social benefits that are promised as going along with being a lower weight. It's no wonder that dieting can feel like a heroic act. Finally, this last medical ethical concept is justice. So that is the concerns of the distribution of scarce health resources and the decision of who gets what treatment, so fairness and equality. And I think in obesity medicine, there's this belief that the benefits of weight loss outweigh any of the harms and that any collateral damage is worth it. And clearly this too is a matter of perspective, even if it's written into medical ethics. I'm going to move on now to the moral foundations theory. This framework was developed by Jonathan Haidt and Jesse Graham, who are psychologists, who set out to investigate the value systems and moral lenses and how they relate to political leaning. They argue that rather than rationalizations, we form our moral beliefs through a kind of universal intuitive ethics. And they discovered it happened along about five dimensions. So authority respect, fairness reciprocity, in-group loyalty, harm versus care, and finally purity sanctity. So each one of us scores differently across these five spectrums. And when they looked at individuals' scores in the five areas and compared them with political affiliation, they found a really clear pattern. More conservative-leaning people tended to score more strongly on the authority, respect, in-group loyalty, and purity sanctity scores, and liberal leaners tended to score more strongly on fairness, reciprocity, and care versus harm. So you can see where you fall by taking the Moral Foundations questionnaire, and I've put the link in the supporting materials if you're interested in doing that. Anyway, a while ago, and mostly because I'm drawn to reading comment sections like a moth to a flame, I observed that the negative discourse around haze, around fat activism, fat medicine, and fat bodies often echoed the sentiments defined in moral foundations theory. So particularly the in-group, out-group stuff, purity, sanctity, and authoritarianism, and the arguments made by size acceptance advocates often operate along the harm versus care and fairness reciprocity axis. I found this theory really useful to help respond to people, as it helps you pick up which moral foundation is being triggered and respond along the same foundation. For example, a clinician who's aggravated that their larger client is what's called non-compliant, i.e. they're not following the advice that they've been given. Talk about paternalism. Is giving us the gift of signalling that they are being challenged along the axis of authority and respect. So a comeback along a different axis is not going to hit the mark. For example, if I countered with intentional weight loss can be really harmful for some people, which operate along the care versus harm, this is not what matters to that clinician. They are annoyed that someone isn't following their advice. To respond along the same axis, we can evoke a party that is more authority than the clinician and point out that they acknowledge that it's unreasonable to expect clients to follow all recommendations and that alliance building, like motivational interviewing, is more likely to lead to behaviour change rather than advice giving. So moaning about their errant client, they've told you that they feel comfortable operating in a power hierarchy because they expect their clients to as well, and that they will respect the advice of those seen as having authority. So find that advice from above and you're in a good position to help that clinician to release the client from blame and see the circumstances as a counselling skills deficit rather than an insult to the clinician. Okay, so I'm going to go through those five moral dimensions now. I'm going to start with authority, respect. Those who score highly on this axis value honouring the traditional way of doing things, submitting to legitimate authority. It's the opposite of subversion. And this factor also comes along with a strong dislike of change. If we think about the history of the obesity epidemic, it itself can be thought of as a wave of change that has been thrust upon humanity, with those responsible seen largely as people in larger bodies, and individuals with larger bodies then become symbols for unwanted change in the life of humanity. So fat bodies have come to be seen to be subversive, particularly through the erasure of their existence prior to the obesity epidemic. In reality, all human populations have had a spread of body weights. Even 60 years ago, when the insurance companies became interested in weight as a premium calculating metric, the average BMI in the adult population was 25, with a wide spread on either side. But the obesity epidemic narrative makes it seem as though body diversity didn't exist until the 1980s. So to counter this dimension, as I mentioned earlier, evoking those with more power by providing clinical guidelines specific to their profession and location and relevant research papers and reminding them that bodily autonomy is a human right and enshrined in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. The second axis, fairness, reciprocity. So this is the basic human desire for fairness and justice. And this dimension also includes the concept of reciprocity, which, for example, is fair pay for a fair day's work, and in healthcare, that effective treatments in exchange for payment. So in this dimension, the more expensive treatments should be more effective than cheaper treatments, how it feels. Remember, this is an intuitive type of ethics. And this is why people, especially desperate people with a life-limiting illness or a loved one with one, will often pay incredible amounts of money or crowdfund incredible amounts of money for dubious treatments, because if they lean strongly towards this fairness reciprocity axis, they'll be more vulnerable to being taken for a ride by charlatans. They see the elaborate treatment and huge cost as evidence that it must work, because they assume the two almost must always go together. Without this desperation element, this dimension works from the other direction of the effectiveness cost reciprocity equation, with those who strongly value fairness and reciprocity feeling deeply outraged if the effectiveness doesn't match the high cost, like being charged thousands of dollars for receiving a Band-Aid in an American emergency department and observing people forego their safe, free municipal water supply to spend their hard-earned money on brightly packaged promise water. In the discourse involving people in fat bodies, fairness reciprocity has multiple themes. The most ubiquitous of these is in online comments is the burden on the healthcare system / my tax dollars / my insurance premiums narrative. Now, there's new research out of Australia showing that fat women who eat more veggies are in fact the lowest cost users of taxpayer-funded healthcare services. In Australia, our primary healthcare visits are mostly funded by our government-owned universal healthcare system, which is mostly funded by income tax. And of course, some of that lower cost in the study will be healthcare service avoidance due to the experience of weight stigma. But the study population was diverse and followed for 10 years. So if there was a major difference between the cost of smaller versus larger people, this would have been blindingly obvious in that data. It wasn't, and the authors were deliciously perplexed. The other usual argument against the My Tax Dollars claim is, of course, that larger people work and pay tax, and their taxes pay for all sorts of other things that aren't related to fatness as well. So the argument sort of falls apart. The fairness reciprocity dimension also takes a form in the beliefs about the effect that the quality of somebody's dietary pattern has on their weight and shape. So people tend to strongly believe and continue to perpetuate the belief, if they're policymakers or talking heads, that if a person eats a mostly, say, minimally processed whole food diet, that their body will naturally become smaller. And also the opposite, that if somebody doesn't eat that way, that their body will express this via increasing body weight. Kind of like body size is some sort of direct expression of how many veggies that person eats. Now, I know that you know that that is absolutely not true. I've talked before about how the proportions of people who eat well, moderately, and poorly are remarkably stable across all the BMI bands. And this is a phenomenon that's been established in American and Australian populations at least. And that body weight tends to increase over time and accelerates with weight loss dieting until later adulthood. But when we see that this belief sits firmly in the fairness reciprocity dimension, it becomes clearer why it is that many of our colleagues who strongly advocate for justice in other areas have trouble recognising that they have a blind spot for injustices towards fat people. Their diet beliefs are getting in the way. In addition to, and definitely after, helping people unpack some of those unfounded beliefs about bodies, food and dieting, moving them on to understand weight stigma, weight discrimination and fat erasure can reignite that fairness reciprocity fire, this time in a manner that actually helps people in larger bodies instead of harms. Thirdly, we've got in-group loyalty. So in-group loyalty relates to feelings of patriotism, self-sacrifice for the good of the group, and feeling pride about being part of a group. Ensuring that you're part of a larger collective feels like it confers safety and protection from threats. Each of us has multiple in-groups. For example, health professionals have their professional identity, which is a form of in-group. Then we have our family, then also perhaps racial, ethnic, cultural, religious, age, gender, sports, or interest groups that we're part of. When we're unable to be in a group that we really want to be in or are rejected from one that we value, it feels excruciating. And to certain groups, fatness is considered as evidence of selfishness, a lack of self-sacrifice for the good of the group, the my tax dollars argument again. Dieting itself can be seen as a performance of in-group loyalty. Being the good fatty and demonstrating efforts to no longer be fat scores loyalty points and can relieve some of the social pain of group exclusion. It's totally understandable that people diet. And look, in-group loyalty isn't necessarily a bad thing. It's a way that individuals make sense of their place in the world, their identity, and are able to shore up their personal safety. I mean, fat activism also operates strongly on the in-group loyalty axis and can be performative to an extent, with the sacrifices of those who bear the brunt of criticism and harm in the process of pushing back at weight centrism, doing so for the benefit not only people who identify as fat, but also those who don't know that they're being harmed by weight centrism. All of these characteristics of morality can be used for both nefarious and decent purposes, depending on how the conditions, the perspectives of the individual, are manipulated. So my advice here is, if you've been excluded due to your appearance, find some new groups where you feel like you belong without having to tie yourself in knots. It's the jobs of those who are already effortlessly accepted in the groups and who are respected in them to redefine inclusion characteristics. Yelling from the outside is ineffective. And this is why fat activism and fat medicine needs thin allies. The fourth dimension now, purity and sanctity. So the purity and sanctity dimension includes religious beliefs and feelings of piety, moral and physical cleanliness, as well as an abhorrence for things considered disgusting, which can include states or actions. It includes a deep fear of contamination. And this has helped the success of humanity as a species in terms of hygiene and some aspects of health, but the payoff is that we all have the capability and inbuilt urge to apply this moral lens to just about anything. Studies of political affiliation, those foundational studies of this theory, and attitudes towards various controversial factors such as immigration and abortion consistently show that the purity-sanctity axis trumps all the others. If you can persuade someone that something is clean and pure or dirty and disgusting, you'll influence them more effectively than if you start with one of the other moral dimensions. And there are countless examples of this, but if we keep it in the food domain, the rise of clean eating and resulting disordered state of orthorexia is a perfect example of the power of manipulating the idea of disgust. The premise of clean eating is that what is disgusting is unseen, so in our bodies or in the food that we eat, and so we're compelled to buy products and information to tell us how to avoid being contaminated. If we think about poor old gluten, which for people with celiac disease is both a contaminant and harmful, but for everyone else is pretty innocuous, the narratives around contamination and harm are so strong that they've infected those who are vulnerable to concern about purity and harm, even though they have no need to worry about such things themselves. Larger bodies are sometimes painted as a social contaminant, a type of bodily corruption, a failure to control base impulses. So it works strongly along the purity sanctity axis too, labelling foods as good, bad, healthy, unhealthy, junk, contaminated, fake, etc. directly work in the purity sanctity dimension. Of course, it's also relevant in narratives around health and illness. A diseased body may certainly involve disgusting aspects, but bodies without disease are no less gooey or smelly. Assuming it so triggers that purity sanctity judgment, portraying larger bodies alongside other markers of perceived impurity like sloppy clothing, unkept personal grooming, fast food, etc., amplifies the messaging about larger bodies being impure. Just being in a larger body and knowing that it is no more clean, dirty, pure, contaminated than smaller bodies isn't enough to counter these incorrect beliefs. The myth of the effectiveness of dieting allows people to live in a perpetual state of denying their own lived experience. They believe that their higher weight is only a temporary state, with them simply waiting for the right circumstances for them to be able to bring it under control. So they feel like they're not like other fat people. So even people who are at a higher body weight hold prejudicial and incorrect beliefs about people in larger bodies. And the final dimension is consideration of harm, which they've called harm versus care. And this dimension is about valuing care and seeking to avoid harming people or other things, especially those who they see as vulnerable. So in order to be seen as vulnerable or deserving of care, people have to be considered in their in-group and also not impure. So this axis can be quickly diminished by manipulating those two other dimensions. So we see that because people in larger bodies are othered through the assumption that their body size is proof that they're not self-sacrificing for the good of the group, you know, so larger people are therefore no longer visible in terms of in-group loyalty, as well as seen as impure via the food corruption link. If we think about the Me Too movement and observe how aggravating it is to some that there are men who need the gravity of violence against women to be put into the context of their own mother or own wife or own daughter before they can see it as an issue of importance. This is a clear case of family-based in-group loyalty. And as we step up the hierarchy of purity and in-groupness, the family unit is at the top, especially if it's a family that hasn't experienced fracture or trauma, or at least that the power holders in it haven't, and particularly ones that sit on a strong cultural or faith-based foundation. And this is also the exact reason why racism, xenophobia, and other forms of othering marginalized communities is associated with terrible treatment, systemic oppression, and genocide. When groups of humans are repeatedly painted as and consequently come to be generally seen as less than human, they've essentially been morally unpersoned, so are neither able to be a recipient of care or capable of experiencing harm. It's a moral escape hatch. This element of human nature is clearly fucked. So what do? Well, we can take every opportunity to raise the voices of those more marginalised than us. We all have intersecting privileges. The important thing is to reach out and pull those with less privilege in towards the centres of power, regardless of whether we personally have a little or a lot of privilege, and push for them to be represented in all of our arenas, speak up to defend them, and furiously help them to reclaim their personhood in the eyes of those who make decisions over their care and harm and autonomy. So we've ended on a heavy note, but that is it for this episode. The supporting materials, which include the show notes, research links, and self-test quiz, are available upfront for current subscribers, only $5 a month, total bargain, or can be purchased in a bundle if you're catching up later. And you can see unpackingweightscience.com for details. Next time, it's the non-diet approach framework, where I'll take you through the clinical model that I've developed during my PhD research. This model is a weight-neutral, size-inclusive body acceptance practice framework for clinicians. Until next time, goodbye.